Chapter 10. Workers in the Factory. Rayon's Dark Past. Resistance. Better Things for Better Living. Through Chemistry. DuPont Advertising Slogan, 1935-82. Why are there some days, wrote Agnès Humer, when we just feel happy for no particular reason? When everything looks wonderful and we are pleased with the whole world, including ourselves. For Agnès, the 15th of April 1941 began as one of those days. As it turned out, her happiness was misplaced. Later that same day, she was arrested by the Gestapo. Agnès may not have looked the part of an insurgent. She was a respectable middle-aged Parisian art historian, with soft round eyes, a large handsome nose, and Marcel-waved hair. But she was also intelligent, courageous, determined, and obstinate, with an incorrigible wit in even the direst of circumstances. Hers was not a character that could long endure injustice or the heavy hand of the Nazi occupation. "I feel I will go mad, literally, if I don't do something," she wrote soon after the fall of Paris. Together with an unlikely band of colleagues from the Musée de l'Homme, Egyptologists, archaeologists and librarians, she formed the first organized resistance group. Printing a newspaper to counter the pervasive official propaganda, they began covertly passing information to the British. What they started, ad hoc and in whispered conversations in the museum's corridors, rapidly grew into a large network. Too large. They were soon betrayed by a double agent. The plainclothes officers found her at the bedside of her sick mother. When they searched Agnès's apartment, they found a copy of a rousing speech by Roosevelt and a draft front page of the group's newspaper. At the top of the page, in bold, incriminating type, was the newspaper's name, Résistance. The group were tried and found guilty by a military court. The men were shot, the women imprisoned and deported to Germany to work as forced labour. When Agnès heard precisely what kind of work she would be doing, she was elated. "We won't be doing war work," her principal determination being not to aid the Nazi cause. "We'll be working in a factory, making artificial silk, spooling the rayon onto bobbins 8 hours a day for making lingerie and stockings." It is difficult to track down the voices of those who make the fabrics we wear and use each day. Historically, few factory workers have written books or articles about their experiences. When we do hear from them, it is often in the form of a scanty quote or answer to a question posed by doctors, activists, or journalists, and frequently only after a disaster. This is what makes Agnès's account so special. She is a vivacious companion, interested in and sympathetic to the details of her new life and those of the other workers. She is also alive to and enraged by injustice, callousness, and petty cruelties. On one occasion, a girl working in the factory has what Agnès believes is a heart attack and is lying prostrate on the floor when the overseer arrives. He pokes his grubby finger in her eyes and, seeing she is not dead but merely unconscious, takes advantage of the opportunity to ogle her breast. As a prisoner and forced labourer, her perspective is different from the many millions who have chosen to produce textiles. Before the war, as a Parisian working in a museum, Agnès knew almost nothing about rayon. She had likely worn it, although she does not say so. Her mother had bought shares in an artificial silk company, mercifully not the one that Agnès was compelled to work for, citing the good return they gave. Apart from this glancing acquaintance, she enters the factory as an average person might, in near total ignorance of the manufacture of a fabric they routinely wear against their skin. In the market. Women want men, career, money, children, friends, luxury, comfort, independence, freedom, respect, love, and cheap stockings that don't run. Phyllis Diller. Almost a year to the day after her arrest, Agnès laid eyes for the first time on the place where she would spend the next 3 years. It was one of the factories owned by a large corporation called Fricks, just outside Krefeld in northeast Germany, half an hour by car from the Dutch border. As a romantic and as an art historian, she would have been charmed to know the etymological root of the fabric that she was to spend the next 3 years producing. In the mid-16th century, rayon was used to denote a ray of light, and in truth, the creation of the first star-pale strand of this first synthetic was rather miraculous, akin to the transfiguration of straw to gold in the fairy tale of Rumpelstiltskin. The raw material for rayon is cellulose, the basic building block of many plants. During the last decades of the 19th century, scientists developed several methods for transfiguring cellulose, usually in the form of wood pulp, into fibre they called artificial or imitation silk. As might be expected, getting from wood pulp, like wood chips only milled a little finer, to a thread soft and shiny enough to resemble silk is a tricky business. To start the process off, the cellulose must first be treated with caustic sodas with a very high pH. Carbon disulfide, CS2, is added, which liquefies the cellulose without damaging its fundamental molecular structure. The mixture is then churned and left to ripen with more caustics until it becomes a thick, almost syrupy liquid known as xanthate. The honey-thick consistency of this mixture is the origin of rayon's other name, viscose, from viscous. When sufficiently gooey, this liquid is forced through small nozzles or spinnerets into tanks of sulfuric acid. The acid forces the carbon disulfide out of the cellulose mixture and hardens what remains, so that fine rayon filaments form in the acid bath and sink to the bottom in piles known as cakes. The fibres are then stretched, cleaned, cut and bleached and, if necessary, dyed, before being woven into fabric. The end result of this process is, perhaps surprisingly, a wonderful fabric. And although few would really think of it as a dupe for silk, it does have similarities. For a start, rayon fabric is extremely soft and drapes well. It also has a subtle silk-like luster. Even more tantalizingly, from a commercial point of view, short lengths of viscose fibre, known as staples, can be mixed with other fibres, such as cotton or wool, before being woven. This has led to the creation of new fabrics to market to consumers, who have also benefited from lower prices. For Western scientists and businessmen, the prospect of finally being able to shake the East's dominance over luxury fabric production was wildly exciting. Dmitry Mendeleev, the Russian chemist who set out the periodic table, warned that because the production of rayon was still in its first or embryonic stage of development, it is best to talk about it with caution. Notwithstanding such reticence, he continued that the victory of viscose will be a new triumph of science, freeing the world in relation to cotton. Some 4 decades after the discovery, this jubilation had not worn off. In 1925, journalists at the Times of London were still smugly proclaiming that the viscose process stands to the credit of British scientists and it has laid the foundation of a great industry. Because of the strong chemicals involved, making rayon was, from the beginning, a highly mechanized process associated with factories, urban workers, and large multinational companies. One of the first to become involved was Samuel Courtauld & Co., later Courtaulds, a British firm keen to produce fabrics on an industrial scale. They opened a rayon factory in Coventry in the first years of the 20th century and, in 1910, created an American subsidiary with its own factory at Marcus Hook in Pennsylvania, trading as the American Viscose Company. This latter site, building on the lessons learned at the former, was equipped to produce 10,000 pounds of rayon each week, with just 480 employees. The efficiency of such large factories, as well as the cheap cost of fabric produced, proved a winning formula, even, perhaps even especially, in troubled economic times. The rayon industry flourished, for example, during the First World War, which disrupted the supply lines of silk and cotton, thereby increasing the demand for synthetics. The Great Depression also helped secure rayon's place in the fabric firmament. The American rayon industry in 1936, for example, was enjoying an 80% increase in production compared to 1931. By this time, in addition to the major firms in Britain, Courtauld's, and America, Courtauld's and DuPont, rayon manufacturers had sprung up in Italy, SNIA, Germany, Glanstoff, and Japan, Taikoku Rayon Company and Toyo Rayon Company, all of which were pumping out ever more rayon fibre. Many of these companies diversified into other synthetic fabrics as well, DuPont being the ne plus ultra. DuPont opened their first rayon factory in Buffalo, New York in 1920, and another in Tennessee. By the mid-1960s, it was the leading firm in America's $19.1 billion chemical industry and the world's largest manufacturer of synthetic materials. By this time, by far their most profitable and well-known fibre was nylon, the first to be based on a fossil fuel. At the time, this meant rayon, produced using wood pulp, was cheaper than its petrochemical-dependent rivals. Since then, the latter have come down significantly in price, and this relationship is now reversed. Research into the creation of a thermoplastic fibre began in 1930. DuPont had claims to nylon 66, today the standard in clothing, while the German chemical company IG Farben worked on nylon 6, now commonly used in furnishings. Less than a decade after research began, nylon entered the marketplace. In America, DuPont focused on the hosiery market, a shrewd choice. As hemlines rose during the 1930s, stockings became indispensable. Prior to the creation of nylon versions, most were made of silk, which, although they felt lovely against the skin, were difficult to wash, expensive, didn't stretch, and were prone to snags. Women grudgingly purchased an average of 8 pairs each year. DuPont dipped their toe into the market by holding a sale of their stockings for the wives of employees in Wilmington, Delaware, on the 24th of October, 1939. Within hours, all 4,000 pairs, each costing $1.15, the equivalent of $20 today, had been sold. The same thing happened when they went on general release on the 16th of May the following year. Every last one of the 4 million pairs that the firm had produced was snapped up within 48 hours. DuPont created just over 2.5 million pounds of nylon in 1940 alone, earning them $9 million in sales. Within 2 years, they had captured 30% of the hosiery market. Their timing was fortuitous. Most of America's silk was imported from Japan, trade that was threatened by escalating tensions between the two countries. In August 1941, imports were stopped entirely. DuPont rapidly stepped up production to cover the shortfall, but after the attack on Pearl Harbor, nylon too was diverted to the war effort. Parachutes, shoelaces, mosquito nets, and aircraft fuel tanks took precedence over consumer luxuries. Women on both sides of the Atlantic, suddenly denied stockings, were forced to get creative. Cosmetic companies brought out makeup that could replicate the look of stockings. Helena Rubinstein's was called leg stick. Other popular varieties were called leg silk and silk toner. Department stores introduced special makeup bars where you could get paint-on stockings, complete with trompe-l'œil seams and stocking tops drawn on with eyebrow pencils and a steady hand. At home, women improvised with gravy browning. By the time nylon stockings went back on sale in 1945, women were frantic. leading to scenes on shop floors later referred to as the Nylon Riots. In Pittsburgh, 40,000 people formed a line that stretched over a mile to buy one of only 13,000 pairs one store had in stock. In other areas of the wardrobe, nylon and other synthetics were at first accepted for their utilitarian virtues. In 1964, an article in the New York Times suggested that, after a day of travelling, the enterprising woman rinsed out her dress along with her stockings and her lingerie before she went to bed, so that she could be fresh for the next day's tour without touching an iron. Practicality could be profitable. Between 1940 and 1967, nylon alone had earned DuPont $4.27 billion. Other synthetics, such as acrylic, marketed by DuPont as Orlon, polyester, Dacron, and spandex, Lycra, had to work harder initially to win over customers. By this time, however, consumers were spending more, particularly in America. By 1970, American consumer spending represented two-thirds of GNP, and family incomes were higher than ever before. DuPont and other synthetics firms were also adept at marketing. As early as 1897, Courtaulds were exploiting the social conventions of wearing black during mourning to sell their wares. One advertisement listed the correct period of ladies' mourning, which ranged from a year and a day for a widow to 3 months for a cousin. Up the side of this list, in large bold letters, is the helpful legend, Courtauld's crepe is waterproof. By the middle of the 20th century, as more synthetics and fabrics blended from mixtures of synthetic and natural fibres came on the market, the importance of advertising increased. In 1962, DuPont spent $10 million to market their products. By 1970, this had increased to $24 million. Paris remained the epicentre of the international fashion trade, and newspapers faithfully reported the shows twice a year. Where Parisian designers went, the global mass market would follow. DuPont, therefore, began forging a relationship with the Chambre syndicale de la couture parisienne, the organization that coordinated the biannual couture shows. Designers from the Chambre syndicale were soon creating their clothes in synthetics. In return, DuPont had them beautifully photographed and generated publicity for the couture houses. In 1953, for example, they invited Hubert de Givenchy to visit their headquarters, and the following year he used a blend of all-on acrylic in a turquoise shirt dress. In 1955, the firm secured a special coup when 14 synthetics appeared in collections by Dior and Chanel. As fashions changed over the following decade, consumers became ever hungrier for stretchy, form-fitting and casual clothing, an aesthetic that precisely suited synthetic and synthetic blend fabrics. The biggest obstacle they faced was a persistent snobbery at the higher end of the market, which it seemed no amount of Parisian endorsement could quash entirely. Nylons and other synthetics still needed talking up a decade later. The lexicon of nylon fabrics has expanded far beyond the careful traveller's puckered nylon of a decade before, readers of the 1964 New York Times article were assured. Brushed nylon fabrics look like velvet. Ribbed effects suggested corduroy. Fleeces are suitable for outerwear or loungewear, and double knits resemble wool jersey. Evidently, the industry was still trying to persuade customers that synthetics were very nearly as good as the real thing. At the distance of a few feet, one designer was quoted as saying, "It is difficult even for an expert to distinguish many synthetic fabrics from natural ones." Despite teething problems, synthetic fabrics were cheap, plentiful, modern, and convenient, attributes that all but guaranteed their success. This came at the expense of natural fibres, particularly cotton. In 1960, American mills used 6.5 billion pounds of fibre, of which 64% was cotton and 29% synthetics. A decade later, the situation was reversed. While the overall amount of fiber used had increased by a third, 58% of what was being used was synthetics, and cotton made up just 39%. Such visible success and large profits attracted competition. In 1955, DuPont controlled 70% of America's synthetic fiber market. By 1965, their market share had dropped to roughly half. Nevertheless, their profits continued to increase. Consumer appetite for cheap, fashion-led and stretchy clothing was near insatiable. Welcome to the factory. The enormous machine hall around me, vast as a cathedral. The machines, 20 meters long and perfectly mysterious to me, are all protected by glass constructions, like greenhouses. Everything inside seems to be in perpetual motion, twisting, turning, rising, falling. I am struck by the unfamiliarity of it all, the noise, and the appalling stench of the acid. Agnès Humbert, Résistance, 1946. There was much about the making of synthetic fibres that consumers didn't know, and probably still don't. The proliferation of chemical companies making different fibres, all with a penchant for coining new trademarks for each new blend or tweaked formula, made it practically impossible for people to keep track of exactly what they were buying. As an article in the New York Times put it in 1964, most of these brand names are meaningless to the consumer and often are not recognizable to people in the trade. Rayon alone has numerous aliases: artificial or imitation silk, art silk, viscose, bamboo, modal, lyocell, and viscose rayon. The suffering of textile workers was also invisible to consumers. Alice Hamilton, an American doctor specializing in occupational health, had cause to mention textile workers and rayon factories many times during her career. In an early review of the hazards facing workers in Pennsylvania, for example, she wrote of the light, fluffy dust that assailed those working in mills, as well as the fatigue caused by the noise, jarring, and monotonous work which yet demands constant attention. War made conditions worse as demand increased. Enrico Villani, an Italian doctor, wrote that during the Second World War, rayon factories in Piedmont increased the working day to 12 hours, even during blackout conditions, in a bid to ramp up production. During the war, forced labour wasn't uncommon. A Fricks factory near Littenberger used labour from the nearby Neuengamme concentration camp, as did another German rayon manufacturer in the Bohemian countryside at Lovosice. By 1943, one in four Glanstoff workers was a forced labourer or prisoner of war. When an IG Farben factory at Wolfen was liberated by the Allies, the workers who had been forced to work there rioted and set the factory on fire. As well as being morally repugnant, the use of slave labour at rayon factories made for recalcitrant, rebellious, inexperienced, malnourished, overworked and underage workers who were extremely vulnerable to accidents. Agnès herself, despite becoming a grandmother while she was working there and being in poor health throughout, was expected to operate machines on her own for up to 12 hours each day without formal training. She and her fellow workers were also routinely physically abused by their overseers. For the first few months, she worked only with the finished rayon thread. This had its fair share of difficulties. It was thirsty work because of the rayon dust that we swallow with every breath. Forced labourers were permitted only two loo breaks each day and weren't allowed to use the water fountain at all. Indeed, they were only allowed to drink at the overseer's discretion. Even so, it was clear to Agnès from the very beginning where the conditions were worst: the machine hall where the viscose was being made. When she arrived, this area was staffed by free, paid workers, many of them Dutch, and nearly all of them men. They were, she wrote, in a pitiful state. Their overalls are in tatters, eaten away by acid. Their hands bandaged, and they appear to be suffering terribly with their eyes, to the point where they often can't manage by themselves. A fellow worker will hold them by the arm, sit them down, put the spoon in their hand. They appear racked by excruciating pains. What sort of work can this be that causes such torments? Although she didn't yet know it, Agnès was soon to find out. The free workers were melting away from the factory day by day and refusing to return. After a while, the only people the management could compel to work in the spinning room were women, forced labourers, like her. On the floor. Arbeit macht frei. Work sets you free. Slogan on the entrance to Auschwitz and other Nazi concentration camps. In April 1887, a 27-year-old man was brought to the Hudson River State Hospital for the insane. 12 days later, another man was forcibly interned. Both, it turned out on further investigation, worked at the same rubber factory. A few months later, in high summer, a third patient arrived at the same hospital from the factory. He was, according to reports, in a condition of great mental excitement, disturbing the neighbourhood by loud noises and violent praying. Frederick Peterson, chief of the nervous department at New York's College of Physicians and Surgeons, took an interest and determined that all three had inhaled large doses of the same chemical, carbon disulfide. Carbon disulfide is, according to its biographer Paul David Blanc, an elegant little molecule, consisting of a single carbon atom sandwiched between two sulfur ones. It occurs rarely in nature. Volcanic fumaroles are one habitat, but was created artificially by a German chemist in 1796. From the mid-19th century, it was used to vulcanize rubber. This method was called cold process vulcanization. Another relied on heat and pressure to make everything from bathing caps to tires and India rubber condoms. The medical dangers became obvious almost from the moment it was used. 40 years before the three young men were incarcerated at the Hudson River State Hospital, a French chemist published a textbook raising the alarm. France at this time was a European centre for vulcanisation, so its scientists and doctors were the first to recognise the grave risks that carbon disulfide posed to those handling it. This chemist didn't go so far as to say that the use of carbon disulfide should cease, but instead suggested that vulcanization should only take place in the open air. 2 years later, Guillaume Duchesne de Boulogne echoed the warnings in a presentation to the Medical Surgical Society of Paris. He had observed that people exposed to this chemical appeared to become mentally deranged in a similar manner to those suffering end-stage syphilis, a fearsome venereal disease that had run rampant during the 19th century. These warnings were slow to spread, and, even once awareness had been raised in the rubber industry, no one thought of assessing the risks involved with its use in making viscose. Part of the problem is the great and diffuse range of symptoms exposure to carbon disulfide causes. A report drawn up in 1941 lists around 30, ranging from the mild, foggy vision and loss of appetite, to the terminal. Death from respiratory failure. Early medical accounts, almost exclusively conducted on male patients by male doctors, were horrified to note sexual side effects. A French physician reported the case of a 20-year-old who was suffering constant erections. Another patient, a 27-year-old whose case was further advanced, appeared aged beyond his years and had seen his sexual desire and erections abolished. As well as physical effects, carbon disulfide exposure can cause a range of psychological symptoms. Workers and their wives reported subtle personality changes, violent, disturbing dreams, confusion, headaches, and in extreme cases, acute insanity. Dr. Thomas Oliver wrote that some of those working with this chemical became so frenzied they precipitated themselves from the top rooms of the factory to the ground. A study of a Pennsylvania community found that 10 workers at the nearby rayon factory had been committed to the asylum one after another. One became so violent he had to be subdued by 4 policemen. He later died of his injuries. Another man tried to stuff a rock down his own throat. Dr. Alice Hamilton described a couple of men she had examined in 1923, both of whom worked in a well-ventilated treatment room at a rayon factory near Buffalo. The first man was tall and gaunt, with a nervous manner, easily excited and irritated by questions, and unable to bear opposition. He had initially felt weak in the legs and nervous, with a pronounced shake like a palsy sufferer. His spirits were very depressed. He was drowsy all the time. He could fall asleep at any moment. His colleague was much better physically, but in a very emotional and nervous state, although trying hard to control himself. He was suffering from hallucinations, and midway through the interview with Dr. Hamilton, his self-control gave way, and he buried his head in the pillow and burst into tears. Problems with carbon disulfide were international and continued well into the middle of the century, despite many cases of misadventure and insanity. In Italy, the Institute for Insurance Against Accidents and Occupational Diseases recorded 83 cases between 1934 and 1937. In 1938, however, the number of cases suddenly spiked. 83 cases were recorded in that year alone. 16 involved a permanent disability, 1 proved fatal. Later, during the Second World War, Dr. Enrico Vigliani, who was fascinated by occupational health, particularly at Visco's factories, noted how some factories seemed to be far worse than others at protecting their workers. He encountered 43 cases of carbon disulfide poisoning of Visco's workers at 4 factories in Milan between 1943 and 1953. Of these, 21 came from one factory, 18 from a second. The third and fourth factories had just 2 cases apiece. Troublingly, the damage done by even brief exposure to carbon disulfide in rayon factories sometimes proved irreversible. Dr. Vigliani saw over 100 exposed rayon workers in Piedmont between 1940 and 1941. Many had difficulty walking, suffering with knee pain and a continual feeling of heaviness in their legs. 5 had developed signs of psychosis. When he re-examined some of these patients in 1946, 1 was recovered, 4 had improved, 5 were unchanged, and the condition of 10 had worsened. While these official and medical reports are horrifying enough, it is clear that they provide an incomplete picture of the situation. Many of those working in rayon factories were poor, ill-educated, and desperately needed to keep their jobs. This made them keen to keep working, even at the expense of their health. The gaunt man that Dr. Hamilton spoke to had been given 6 weeks' complete rest and, she judged, had no inclination to exaggerate his disability, rather the contrary, for he was keen to work again. The medical reports are also often flawed or incomplete. The Italian figures quoted by Dr. Vigliani only include cases where those involved received compensation. It is reasonable to assume that this was the tip of the iceberg. Official reports could also be manipulated by factory owners and overseers unwilling to take responsibility for harm done to workers. Dr. Hamilton once spoke to the manager of a white lead works, who exclaimed indignantly, "Do you mean to imply that if one of my men gets lead poisoning, I am to be held responsible?" A similar attitude prevailed in the textile industry. In both America and Britain, cases of persistent eye problems were routinely described as conjunctivitis, even after proof emerged that exposure to carbon disulfide was really causing keratitis, a less innocuous condition. In the early 1960s, when presented with evidence of the harm that carbon disulfide could do to workers, Courtauld stalled and prevented research from going forward. As late as the 1990s, they sent a sharp rejoinder to a proposed government health hazard evaluation study. DuPont, on the other hand, began studying the effects of the chemicals they were using on workers in 1935 and imposed safety limits on the amount of carbon disulfide that was acceptable in their factories. Agnès and her fellow forced labourers had no idea. They were never told what the chemicals they were handling were or what harm they could do. The term carbon disulfide doesn't appear once in Résistance. She vaguely refers to nearly all the chemicals that they worked with as acid. They learn on the job from each other. With very little supervision, each new horror comes as a surprise. Something they discover early is to try to avoid the molten viscose. They were working with open vats, without the safety hoods and equipment normally used to protect workers. It produces terrible burns, like phosphorus, Agnès writes soon after she has begun working with viscose. It sticks to the wounds it causes and is impossible to remove, eating the flesh away to the bone. Unlike the civilian workers, who were given safety equipment and gloves, slave labour at the Fricks plant had to manage in fabric trousers and shirts that were quickly eaten away, leaving some of the women in a state of near nudity on the factory floor. The disregard shown for their safety is chilling. One day a worker has a violent epileptic fit at her machine, foaming at the mouth dreadfully, while her body arched and jolted from one side of the central corridor to the other. Agnès and the others look on in horror, but the overseers and wardress found this highly amusing. Within half an hour, she is back at her machine. Later, the fits become a weekly occurrence. As the war drags on, conditions worsen. Rations decrease, and the hours they are expected to work lengthen. Soon they are working 60 hours each week and are pulling 12-hour shifts 2 Sundays out of every 3. The consequences for the health of the workers are inevitable. When Henriette, Agnès's friend, is blinded by the carbon disulfide and suffering terrible cramps and leg pain, all she is given is aspirin and some eye drops. Agnès, naturally clumsy, is constantly getting injuries caused by splashes of viscose. Some falls on her foot, eating it away until it becomes infected. She has spilt so much on her hands that the skin becomes grey and painful. She cannot sleep, and soon enough she too begins to suffer from spells of blindness. First of all, you are plunged into a dense fog. Then the pain starts, streaming eyes and nose, followed by stabbing pains in the eyes, a splitting headache, and excruciating pains in the back of the neck. Agnès and her companions were also, although they were unaware of it, experiencing psychological symptoms. Everyone sleeps badly, and desperate suicide attempts become routine. A young Austrian girl hides behind her machine and swallows a tumblerful of liquid taken from the rayon vat. Later, 3 women try to end their lives within 24 hours. One throws herself out of a window, another down a stairwell. The 3rd, Henriette, slashes her wrists with broken glass. Agnès's spirit, however, remained unbroken. When American soldiers liberated the factory and its workers at the end of the war, they were astonished by her energy. She immediately began helping them round up local Nazi officials who remained at large and set up soup kitchens for refugees. At the latter, she insisted that everyone be given a share, including German civilians. Fast fashion, old problems. This is a story of exploitation. Abir Abdullah, photographer based in Dhaka, 2015. At 9:03 on Wednesday morning, the 24th of April, 2013, a large 8-story building collapsed as suddenly and completely as if its concrete components had been held together by nothing more substantial than silken threads. There were 3,122 people inside at the time, the majority of them female garment workers, many of whom had their children with them. There had been warning signs. Another factory had collapsed 8 years previously, and a few months before, a fire had broken out in another garment maker's nearby. This particular building had never been intended to house factories. The foundations, having been built on a filled-in pond, were unable to withstand the weight and vibrations of industrial use, besides which 4 extra floors had been added without building permits. More damning still, major structural cracks had been discovered the day before. Several other commercial businesses that shared the building, including a bank and some shops, had evacuated their staff, despite the claims of the building's owner that it was safe. The garment workers, however, were ordered back to work. Managers at one firm threatened to withhold that month's wages if they refused. In all, 1,134 people were killed by the collapse of the Rana Plaza building in Bangladesh in 2013, and many more were injured. Some of the survivors remain deeply traumatized from having been trapped for many hours, even days, in the rubble, surrounded by the bodies of colleagues and friends. The last person to be found alive was a woman called Reshma, pulled from the wreckage of her workplace, her face powdered with sticky beige dust, 17 days after it had collapsed. Many survivors still able to work soon returned to jobs in the garment industry. Few other opportunities were available, and they needed the money. 3 years later, 38 people, including Sohel Rana, the owner, were charged with murder. Many of the conditions and the wider context, however, remain unchanged. Bangladesh is one of the world's poorest countries, and yet in 2013, it was the world's second largest clothing exporter behind China. Some 5,000 factories employed 3.2 million workers, many of them women. After Rana Plaza, exports actually rose 16% to $23.9 billion. Cheap and plentiful labor, the minimum wage at the time of the accident was just $37 a month, makes it a popular place for large Western brands to outsource production. Labels found amidst the Rana Plaza wreckage included Primark, Mango, Walmart, and Benetton. Despite the presence of such large and profitable companies, redress for those affected by the disaster was slow in coming. It took 5 months for a committee to be set up to compensate the families of those who died. By the one-year anniversary of the disaster, only $15 million of the required $40 million had been raised. Benetton, who had sourced 266,000 shirts from Rana Plaza over the 6 months before its collapse, was finally shamed into paying into the compensation fund in 2015. Activists mounted a photograph of a victim of the disaster on a van that was driven around Treviso, home of the firm's global headquarters. Today's large mass-market fashion brands rely on synthetic fabrics. Without them, fast fashion probably wouldn't exist. Synthetics are cheap, quick to produce, and can be readily made to order in exact quantities, colours, and prints in time for the fortnightly, weekly, or even daily drops of new clothes that the largest and most successful brands, such as Zara, H&M, and Topshop, demand. Synthetics make up well over 60% of a global fibre market that is steadily growing. Americans increased their spending on clothing and footwear 14% over the 5 years between 2011 and 2016, up to $350 billion in total. Similar or greater increases have been seen elsewhere. Rising populations and burgeoning middle classes, desirous of having the trappings of wealth, means more fabric for furnishings, clothes, and shoes. In 2016, the market for fibres increased 1.5% to 99 million tonnes. We are making far more than we could ever reasonably need. In 2010, for example, it was estimated that 150 billion garments were stitched together, enough to provide each person alive with 20 new articles of clothing. Environmentally, synthetic fabrics are a disaster. Polyester, one of the cheapest synthetics, is essentially a plastic derived from crude oil. Not only do polyester garments usually end their days as landfill, but they constantly shed plastic filaments. By some estimates, these fibers are among the most abundant environmental debris in the world. Synthetics are also hungry for resources. For most synthetics, this is oil. For rayon, it is cellulose. In Canada, the Amazon, and Indonesia, old-growth forests are being cut down for their wood pulp. Canopy, an environmental organization, believes that 120 million trees are felled each year to produce rayon and other cellulose-based materials. In Indonesia, bamboo is often planted over the site of felled trees to produce fabrics that can then be marketed as being renewable and environmentally friendly. Because rayon is made from cellulose, it is ripe for greenwashing, especially when consumers are fuzzy about how it's made. In 2013, Amazon, Macy's, and Sears were among the brands forced to pay fines totaling $1.26 billion for allegedly falsely labeling textiles as bamboo when they were rayon. This, according to the Federal Trade Commission, was tantamount to duping consumers who were trying to be environmentally conscious. For the most part, the dirty work of producing synthetic fibres has been outsourced to areas of the world where labour is cheap and regulations are lax. Around 65% of the world's viscose is made in China. India and Indonesia are the world's second and third largest producers, respectively. Although now the production of rayon is highly concentrated, just 10 companies account for 70% of all the rayon produced, which should make accountability easier, problems persist. In West Java, semi-processed viscose waste was found scattered around villages next to one large rayon plant. And factories that have supplied brands including Zara, H&M, Marks & Spencer, Levi's, Tesco, and Eileen Fisher have been caught illegally dumping factory waste into rivers at night, contributing to pollution and poisoning the groundwater. In 2016, it was reported that over 80% of the underground wells providing drinking water across the Chinese plains were unfit for consumption because of pollution. This shouldn't be news. In 1942, the water of the Roanoke River in Virginia near a rayon plant was tested for cleanliness. Researchers drew off tanks of water from the river that had been contaminated with American viscose effluent and put fish in the tanks to see what would happen. No fish survived longer than 10 minutes. They reached the conclusion that the river was now so polluted that not only was it unfit as a habitat for wildlife and for human recreation, but it was also injurious to hydraulic machinery. The human cost of synthetic fabrics and the fast fashion juggernaut that demands that so many of them be made is high, as the factory collapse in Bangladesh shows. The breakneck turnaround and low prices expected by consumers make it an industry highly susceptible to exploiting workers. The apparel industry is the largest employer of women globally, yet fewer than 2% are earning a living wage. Employees also continue to be exposed to grave risks. In the rayon industry, those who don't succumb to obvious carbon disulfide poisoning are still vulnerable. A Chinese study found that exposed male rayon workers have lower semen quality and fewer, less satisfactory sexual encounters. A 1968 study in the BMJ looked at the mortality of rayon factory workers employed at three plants in Flintshire. It found that 42% of all deaths between 1933 and 1962 were due to heart disease. Among the control group, people who hadn't worked around rayon, heart disease was the cause of death only 17% of the time. Chillingly, a former employee of one of these factories, owned by Courtaulds, told Paul David Blanc that women could turn up with their hair in rollers and find their hair permed by the end of the shift because of the amount of sulfur in the air. For the first time in human history, the vast majority of fabric being made has become disposable, something to be consumed and thrown away within weeks or months of being made. Synthetic fibers have made this possible, created in factories far removed from the people who will use them, and sold for a few dollars a kilo. Their value has been worn threadbare. Research is being done into the creation of fibres that are genuinely environmentally friendly to produce and are biodegradable. Fabrics are being grown using mycelium fungi. An alternative to silk is being brewed like beer from genetically modified yeast. Perhaps the biggest change, however, needs to come from those of us doing the buying. It is unlikely that we would ever find ourselves, as Agnes did, working at one of these factories. But perhaps this is a possibility that we should give a little more thought to each time we go shopping.